this edition of the Hagmann Report live on Global Star Radio Network. Thank you, Global Star. Also BTR and YouTube. This is history in the making. We're talking with a gentleman named Doug Papa, who is really, in my viewpoint, from what I'm seeing, we're getting emails from not just the United States, but Canada and multiple countries. This guy is a real hero. And I want to thank you. I want to thank Mr. Doug Papa. And by the way, follow him on Twitter, brand new Twitter account. Get the major updates. That's Doug Papa, P-O-P-P-A. I just follow him on Twitter.
Thanks to Bill McIntosh of Ocaso Media setting this up.
Now, Doug, let me ask you this. During the break, and I know your backstory, I know that you've been through the flipping mill, man, because of exposing corruption, your life's been shattered. Now, I've got a question for you. Do you want to talk about that, or you want to just move on to Las Vegas?
We can talk about anything you want. I could briefly talk about that.
If you don't mind, because I think people need to understand what you, Doug Papa, have gone through exposing corruption, and what, just tell us about your life.
Well, the reason why I lost my police career was in 1992. Well, it started in November 91. 1986, I was going through a divorce, okay? And I was working undercover. I worked undercover pretty much 9 years of my 12-year police career. And, the divorce hit me pretty hard. You know, you got to have your mind focused when you're working undercover because, you're working alone. I mean, it's your life that's at stake, and you have to be focused. And I was getting to the point where the divorce really hit me really hard. There was a lot of extenuating circumstances, and it really hit me hard. So I resigned from the sheriff's office for a couple of months with the intention of coming back. This was in spring of 87, to come back, take 6 months off and then come back. And that's what I did. During that period of time, I got a call from a female a probation officer that I knew. I actually dated her for a while after the divorce. And long story short, there was a gentleman named Frank Hoppus. He was the chief of police in Middleburg, Virginia. And there was a woman, there was a family up there, I don't say family, a husband and wife. There was William Douglas Carter, and his wife was Carol Carter. And they were going through a divorce. And it was like, they were millionaires, had a lot of money, a big mansion up there. And I guess they were going through the settlement proceeding. Okay. And Frank, who was the chief of police in Middleburg, had gotten in touch with Mary, who was the female probation officer that I knew, and said, hey, there's this woman that's looking for a cop or an ex-cop, retired cop, to stay in a house as basically a bodyguard, because of she's going through and she's afraid of husband because the husband, she's saying he's threatened to kill her and all this stuff. You know, like people go through a divorce, you hear all this crazy stuff. So anyway, Mary called me up and, I made contact with the woman. Her name was Carol Carter. And she came up, I think it was the next day, the day after. She picked me up at the house. I was going through a divorce. I was living with a friend of mine who was a sergeant on the, Ed Lacey. He was a sergeant on the sheriff's office. He was getting ready to go to customs, or he just got hired by customs, and he was still in Sterling, Virginia. I was staying with him. So she came over to the house, picked me up, blue Cadillac, and, nice lady. I thought, and we're talking, and she's telling me, all the bad stuff about her husband. At one point, we went over to our daughter's house and we talked. And then after that, we drove to the mansion in Middleburg, Virginia. Middleburg, Virginia in Northern Virginia is a pretty exclusive area. A lot of mansions, hunt country, horse country, and all that. So took him up to the mansion. So as while she's going up there, she shows me, takes out her handbag on the car there, and she shows me a Smith & Wesson snub-nose stainless steel revolver. And I said, what are you doing with that? She said, well, I bought it at the gun shop in Middleburg, and the guy showed me how to use it, or was going to show me how to use it. And blah, blah. Anyway, puts it in the bag, goes to the house. We go inside, and it was a mansion. This is what it was. I mean, they got a basement with a pool table, racquetball, I think, whatever was down there. And she says, you'll be on this side, and my room is, like, way over there. If you have a girlfriend, she could stay here with you. You can use the pool. I mean, it was a mansion. That's what it was. So as we're rolling in, now, I didn't know her husband was still on the property. As we're rolling in, this pickup truck comes right up to the back of her car. It's like a blue pickup, dark colored from what I remember. And I turn around and look, and the truck goes in reverse and backs up to what was a guest house on the property, a guest house. The guest house would be a home to all of us. They called it a guest house. And then she says to me, oh, that's him. and he saw me come in, but being that you're in the car, see somebody in the car, he backed up. And I says, who? She says, Doug, my husband. His name was William Douglas Carter. Everybody called him Doug. And I said, he's here? She says, yeah, he lives over there in the guest house. And I'm thinking, well, Dean, this now complicates things, okay? Because she's saying, you know, he has guns and, you know, he does all this stuff and everything like that. So anyway, go in the mansion. She gives me the tour. Come out. And it is where, at some point, from I remember, this is 25 years ago, she makes the statement to me that she would shoot herself even if she died, if she can make it look like he did it, so he would ruin the rest of his life or spend the rest of his life in jail. Now, I was going through a divorce, too, so, of course, I talked to her. I says, you know, don't talk like that. You know, it's crazy. I says, why don't you just stay? Because she was staying at the time with her daughter in Sterling, Virginia, but she wanted to move back into the mansion. And I says, why don't you just stay with your daughter until the settlement thing? No, it's my mansion. I'm going to go back in there and live like this. So she says, what do you think? You interested? So she dropped me off at the house. And I said, well, I'll, you know, think about it, and I'll let you know tomorrow. And I had a couple concerns at that point. I didn't tell her. One, she showed me her gun. She's making this crazy statement. But, you know, it didn't bother me because people make crazy statements. I heard worse stuff from people going through divorces. Oh, I'll kill the SLB and stuff like that. So, but what concerned me was that he was on the property. So when I asked about it, she says, well, there's a restraining order on him. He can go anywhere on the property, but he can't go into the mansion. So I said, I mean, okay, he's allowed to go in. Yeah, he could be like at the front door, but he can't come into, you know, 20 feet of the mansion or something like this. So I said, well, you know, to me, I'm going to be armed, okay? And he may have a gun. It's going to be a situation that something bad could happen. So I thought about all that stuff. I went home. I called up a friend of mine, Bill Harris, who was he just got promoted to lieutenant on the sheriff's office. We used to work narcotics together. And I told him, you know, what happened. And he said to me, you know, what's going on? Well, I'm kind of concerned about he's there and the statement she's making. And he told me, I think she's setting you up to get in a confrontation with a husband, maybe to kill him or something. That'll be the end of the story. And he said, I wouldn't take the gig. And so I called her back the next morning and I declined. I said, you know, I decline. I said, I appreciate the offer. I think you should remain with your husband with your daughter in Sterling, Virginia. And then she kind of yelled at me and says, you know, if you're afraid of my husband, and blah, blah, blah. I said, ma'am, I'm not afraid of nobody. There's just a situation here with him being on the property. You said he has a gun. If he's standing 15 feet from the door, we go out and he's got a gun in his hand. I mean, this is a situation where something could erupt. I never met the guy. So all I know is what she was telling me about him. I didn't know, you know, if he was bad, good, or anything. So that was the end of that. And this was now 1987 spring. Sometime later, I turn on the television. And I hear that it says Carol Carter, Middleburg, Virginia, was shot in a home allegedly by her husband, and he's up in New York at a farm. And I went in, I ran in, I look at the television, and my stomach's gone from the department. But, you know, once a cop, always a cop. And I'm thinking, the first thing I thought was, man, I felt so bad that had I taken the job and been in that house on the other side, maybe he wouldn't have come in, or maybe I could have prevented it. All this is going through my head. So I felt really bad. I didn't know anything about the case other than what I heard on television. So the next day, I went up to the Criminal Investigations Division, and it was my boss when I was working narcotics was Captain Vernon Beamer. He ran the whole Criminal Investigations Division, and the narcotics unit was part of that. So I was just going to go up there and tell him that I had contact with her, you know, a couple months ago, and this is what she showed me. Showed me the gun, all this. So as I walk in, I see Bill Harris in there, and he's in uniform now doing something because he's a lieutenant. And I said, Bill, that woman I heard, Carter, that's the woman that wanted to hire me, you know. And he goes, yeah, you know, I thought about it, blah-blah. He says, what are you doing? I says, I'm going to go talk to Vernon. He says, well, yeah, Vernon's in the office. Go down and talk to him. So I went in there, and I told him exactly what I just said. You know, she hired me, took the mansion, showed me the gun, made a statement. And he says, you know, the case is wrapped up, Doug. He's in upstate New York with an extradition back, and, you know, he did it, and blah, blah, blah. And you got to understand something at this point, okay? When you're a cop, and I hate to say this, you know, now I know different, but when you're a cop, when a cop tells you something, you agree. Because most cops have the attitude, I'm not going to cuss. I mean, I don't think if I say asshole, is that a curse? Can I say that?
We but just most did. Cops, that's all right.
Yeah, okay. Most cops say, you know, there's cops, and then there's the a-holes,
that's
the regular
right.
people. That's the way they think, that, you know, everybody's guilty, and, you know, there's no, and all that kind of stuff. So he told me that, and I'm thinking, fine. I had nothing to do with the case. I didn't work it. I was not on the sheriff's office at the time. I was gone for a couple of months. So I told him. And I went to Bill, and I said, Bill was there. He goes, yeah, I just told him, you know, what happened. And Bill knew what happened. So, and I left. Now that. Now, January 1988, I'm back on the department. And I hear that the trial's coming up, the attempted murder trial, or whatever they called it in Virginia time, malicious wounding, felony, you know, something like that. But anyway, so I hear that's coming up. So I go and I talk to the prosecutor. His name was William Birch, the Commonwealth attorney in Virginia, other places they call it the district attorney, the top dog. And I walk in and I tell him the whole story about what she told me. She showed me the gun, and that I also told Vernon Beamer, you know, in the spring of 87. Now, this is like January. It was almost immediate when I got back on the sheriff's office. I heard the trial was coming up, so I went and I told him. And he basically says the same thing. Oh, we got an airtight case. Okay. You know, I work with prosecutors for years. You got no reason to doubt him. Okay, I left. I had nothing to do with it. Sometime later, I heard he was found guilty of attempted murder, 14 years in prison, 20, something like that. And then I guess there was an appeal after that. But I had nothing to do with the case. Nobody ever took a statement, deposition. Didn't seem bizarre to me because I told the captain, I told the prosecutor, and obviously I figured they had so much evidence against the guy. Like they said, it was an airtight case and it's wrapped up and blah, blah, blah. So that was the end of that. But that really wasn't the end of that. That was, like I said, you know, I came back on the department January 8th. It was pretty much right after that. And then I hear he's found guilty. And then I heard, you know, later on there was some type of an appeal. And then, now that's in 1988. Now, there was a lot of stuff going on in the sheriff's office that was wrong. We had narcotics missing, from the vault in the courthouse. It was never returned to the evidence room. There was other evidence allegedly missing, motorboat motors, and that was supposedly at the sheriff's house, allegedly in Southern Virginia, and all this stuff, crazy stuff's going on for years. So it was around October, November 1991. I'm coming out of the courthouse. You know, it was like 4.5 years later, and I see Judge Chamblin, James Chamblin. He was a circuit court judge, and, you know, he made a joke to me. He says, "How you doing, Judge?" And he says, "Good, Doug, you know." And he says, "Can I talk to you, or you were undercover?" You know, because I had a beard and long hair and everything. And I said, "No, we could talk." So we were just, you know, talking about different things. But the Carter case was always bothering me because, you know, I never testified. There was a lot of other crooked stuff that was going on. So I told him about it. And he said, "Did you ever testify?" I said, "No, I never did." And did anybody ever take? No, nobody took a report on it. And he said, "Do you know if your statement?" Because I told him what happened with the woman. "Do you know if that statement ever made it to the defense?" I said, "I don't know." He says, "Well, you know that's exculpatory evidence, Brady material and all that." And I said, "Yeah." He says, "What's bothering you?" I says, "Because now I'm back on the department, right?" I says, "Would it be out of line for me to find out who the defense attorney was in that case, and call him and tell him?" He goes, "Doug, I've known you for years. I know you'll do the right thing. What you got to do," something like that. So right after that, immediately, I go into the courthouse. I asked the clerk who was the attorney, and somebody remembered, "Oh, yeah, I think it was Plato Cacheras or something like that." So I went home. I called him up, and I told him who I was. He knew who I was because he had some cases out there in Loudoun. And he says, "What's going on?" And I says, "Well, I want to tell you a story." So he goes like nuts. He says, "What?" And I said, "Yeah, this is what you told me." And I said, "I told Vernon Beamer before the trial in the spring 87, summer 87, spring around there, and I told Bill Birch before the trial." And he's going crazy on the other end of the phone. "I never heard of this," because he was the attorney for Carter, right? And now Carter's in jail for like 4.5 years by this time. So he says, and he's just like going crazy. So he said, "Listen, I'm not his attorney anymore, but do you know that Carter's got new attorneys because he's been maintaining his innocence for years? And he's got new attorneys who are trying to put a motion together for a habeas corpus motion to get him out because they have stuff that to file the habeas motion to get him a new trial." He doesn't elaborate. I said, "No, I don't know anything about that." He says, "I'm going to give your name and information to the new attorneys." Now, this is like nighttime when I'm talking to him, like 5, 6 o'clock. Well, I go to bed, and about midnight, the phone rings. Now, this is 1991, November 91. And it's these two attorneys who are on a conference call, and I don't remember the other guy's name, but John Edwards, not the guy that ran for politics, but John Edwards was one of the attorneys. So he says, "Doug, we got a call from the attorney, and he told us, can you tell us again what you told him?" And they go crazy. They said, "This is not even part of the record." And I tell them, I said, "Let me tell you something. There's witnesses who can corroborate what I'm telling you." And they're just going crazy, right? So they say, "Listen, tomorrow morning in Loudoun County Circuit Court, it's too late to get you a subpoena. We're having the first motion before the judge for this appeal, this habeas corpus motion. would you come down and testify without a subpoena? I'm a cop. Sure, tell the truth. Yeah, no problem. Yeah, I'll be there tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock. So I got off the phone, 1 o'clock in the morning. I called my supervisor up. We call him Rocky. He's William Calaviti. He was already retired from the Fairfax County Police Department and now is the supervisor of narcotics. So I tell him what's going on, and he's on the other line. He says, Doug, man, this is bad, Doug. They're going to come after you. You know what's going to happen. He says, I'll be in the courtroom tomorrow when you testify. Of course, he said, this is just going to blow up. Like, this is just phenomenal. So I go in the courtroom. He's sitting in there. Basically, it was an empty courtroom. It was Judge Horn was on the bench. And see, this is all in my mind. You never forget stuff. Like this in 25 years ago. Well, because it cost me my job. So anyway, it was Judge Horn was the judge on the bench, circuit court judge. My supervisor, Rocky, he was in the courtroom, two women. And when I walked in, I saw the two attorneys, and they came over and shook my hand, and then Doug Carter. And I never met Doug Carter before. So they go up to him and said, this is Detective Papa from the sheriff's office. Of course, now he hates cops because he's alleging basically misconduct and corruption, put him in jail. I later found out that was the basis for the habeas motion. Sure. They didn't know anything about me yet, okay? Except the night before when I talked to them. So I go to shake his hand. He has to shake my hand. And he says, like, what's he doing here? Because now, you know, he hates cops. And they said, no, he has some information that may help us, but we can't get into it. So he just turns around, ignores me, sits down. They put me on the stand. It was just me. Like, this courtroom was basically empty. Mm-hmm. So I tell him what I just told you. Now, at one point when I'm testifying about she showed me the gun and then made the statement to me, I see him turn, Doug Carter, turn around. I couldn't see what he was doing because I'm on the witness stand. And then I'm finished. So I go out. They thank me. And I go out the back door. Rocky comes right out behind me. And he says, Doug, the S is going to hit the fan, man. This is just unbelievable. This is crazy. He says, they're going to come after you. I says, come after me for what? I'm telling the truth. That's what happened. He goes, man, no, this is good. Well, he's just going crazy. But then he says to me, right there, he says, that guy's innocent. You don't know anything about the guy. I said, what? He goes, that man is innocent. I said, how the hell do you know that? He says, did you see what he did when you testified about the woman and the gun and the statement? I said, no, I saw him move. He turned around and started crying, and the woman that was sitting behind him gave him a handkerchief. He said, Doug, that man is innocent. I don't know if he's innocent or guilty. All I knew is that they didn't know about my information. So that happened. The next day, I'm in the sheriff's office. The sheriff was John Isom. He's still alive today. I think he's already 80 years old. As far as I'm concerned, he's a POS, okay? Uh-huh. I'm in his office, and he's telling me, what do you think you're doing? You can open up a can of worms. You keep your mouth shut and blah, 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 blah. And I said, what are you talking about? Keep your mouth shut and all this type of stuff. This is going to blow over. And I said, how could it blow over? I said, because the second part of the habeas motion was going to be January 2nd of 1992. It's now November of 1991. So I said, Sheriff, I said, there could be a guy in jail, like, who's innocent, that they didn't get the evidence. I mean, I don't know if he's innocent or guilty. All I knew is my statement, the exculpatory evidence, didn't come to the defense at the original trial. I now know that. Mm-hmm. So he's basically telling me to keep my mouth shut. And, so I walk out puzzled, like, you know, why is he saying that? Well, at some point, one of the local papers came out, and then basically the prosecutor basically told the paper that I was a perjurer. That I basically lied in court at this hearing.
Wow.
So now I'm ticked off. So I go up to the sheriff's office that morning with the paper under my arm, and I says, what are you going to do about this? And he says, I'm going to do nothing. It's got nothing to do with the sheriff's office. It's between you and Birch, William Birch, the prosecutor. Mm. I says, how can it have nothing to do with the sheriff's office? I'm one of the detective's investigators. Vernon Beamer is the captain. He's still a captain at CID. I told him, you know, in 87... And he says, well, I got news for you. I spoke to Vernon Beamer, and I spoke to Birch. And both of them saying, you never had any conversation with them. They don't know what you're talking about.
Wow.
So I say to him, they're lying. Sheriff, I have witnesses that can corroborate what I testify to. And he ignores me. He says, I told you the other day, you keep your mouth shut. This is going to blow over. You're going to open up a can of worms. I says, he called me a liar in the newspaper. I had commendations, like 25 commendations, letters of commendation from the whole you know, all the years I was on the sheriff's office, almost 12 years. Detective of the year in 1986. I never, you know, nothing bad in my file. And this SOB prosecutor, the Commonwealth attorney, the district attorney for intents and purposes in other states, is calling me a liar. And the sheriff is not backing me up. So I'm walking out like totally bewildered, like what the hell is going on? So I go home, and then the next day or something, one of the reporters made contact with me, and do you want to make a statement? Oh, you're damn right I do. I said, this is what the sheriff said. Birch is lying and Beamer's lying. I told them, I told Vernon Beamer in 87 what I just testified to, and I told Birch before the trial. And the sheriff's telling me to keep my mouth shut. Of course, now that paper comes out, I'm back in the sheriff's office. What the hell do you think you're doing? I told you, you value your job, I can bust you down. You can go in civil process. You better watch what you're doing. You can open up a can of worms. Listen, I said, sheriff, here's how you fix this right now. Initiate an internal affairs investigation. Put Birch on a polygraph, Beamer on the polygraph, and me, and let's see who's telling the truth. He says, there's going to be no I investigation. You keep your mouth shut. And you don't talk to the papers anymore. Now, I'm thinking something's really stinks here, but I don't know what. So now at this time, I was getting hang up phone calls, some threats, hanging up and all this type of stuff. It was getting really bad. Every third day I was in the sheriff's office. You better keep your mouth shut with him, the undersheriff, one of the captains. Finally, I'm not sleeping. I got, it was the day after Thanksgiving of November, Thanksgiving in November of 1991. I called up a friend of mine who was a resident FBI agent, worked out at Dulles Airport for Loudoun County. His name was Al Malinchak. I called him up. I said, Al, I got to talk to you. He goes, yeah, Doug, I see everything going on in the newspapers. What's going on? I says, you know, the whole thing is getting crazy here. So I made an appointment. I think we got Monday. I went down to Tuesday and I spoke to him and I told him everything that happened. I told him about all the other, you know, the missing narcotics. There was a lot of alleged corruption, financial records, and asset money that nobody knew was happening. It wouldn't be all this. I told him everything. I just sat there and I said, listen, boom, this is all right now. So he writes it all up, and then he says, I'm going to forward this to the public integrity section at a headquarters, because Loudoun County is 35 miles west of Washington, D.C. It's a suburb of Washington, D.C. in Virginia. So he said, I'm going to send it to headquarters, and we'll see what happens. So sometime around the beginning of just from my mind, it was somewhere before Christmas of 1991, I get a call, and it's from an FBI agent named Scott Sutherland, and he says, we want to come out, you need to come out to Office of Falls Church. We got authorization from headquarters to initiate a public integrity investigation with the sheriff, so based on what I said. So I went out there, and I met with him and his partner. His name is Tom Fitzpatrick. Tom died. Scott now is I think, director of security, because I connect with him on LinkedIn in Pennsylvania for one of the colleges or hospitals. But anyway, so I go out and meet with Sutherland, and I meet with, you know, what was going on in the Carter case, and then all this other stuff, which they were more concerned with the other stuff, because they didn't want to get into the middle of the Carter investigation, because it was now an appeal, you know, like an appeal for the habeas. But they were interested in that, and they were interested in the asset forfeiture money and all this stuff and the missing drugs. So I told them everything, okay? And then they started asking me, like, crazy questions, like, you know, do you skydive? Do you scuba dive? Well, I used to, not anymore. You drive a motorcycle? Well, I used to, not anymore. And I'm like, what's this stuff about? Well, if something happens to you, we need to know this. Like, if all of a sudden I'm driving my motorcycle and the wheel comes off, did somebody pull the wheel off? Because now they're concerned for my safety. So I said, yeah, I'm not worried about it. You know, I worked 9 years undercover, and I took care of myself. So go out. That was the end of that. 2 days after I talked to the FBI, I'm in the sheriff's office. Now with him, the undersheriff, another POS named Charlie Cooper, he died a couple of years ago. He got what came to him. And they're telling me, what did you talk to the FBI about? They knew I'd gone to the FBI.
Oh, wow.
And that kind of shocked me. I don't know how they knew. I heard later on that somebody said there was somebody at work there, was a girlfriend of somebody, but I don't really know how they knew. But anyway, he says, what did you talk to the FBI? We know you went to the FBI. He even knew it was the Falls Church office of the FBI in Falls Church, Virginia. So I played stupid. I said, I don't know what you're talking about. And he says, we want to know what you told the FBI. And why do you keep talking to the newspapers? I said, well, I keep talking to the newspaper because you're not backing me up for some reason. You don't want to do an IA, and I got to defend my reputation. So we told you to keep your mouth shut. Now, what does the FBI know? So I finally told him. I says, I take out apart, and I go over to his desk, and I get a piece of paper, and I write down a phone number. I give it to him. He goes, "What's that?" "That's the number of the FBI agent. Call him up and ask him what I told him." I says, "Is there anything else?" So I started to go out the door. And he says, "You hold on there." He's now he's cussing, right? He says, "You hold on. I can demote you. You value your job." And now I'm ticked off. And I says, "You do what you got to do, Sheriff. I'm leaving." So I left. And then I thought things were going to get better because now the FBI's looking into things. They know it. They're going to lay off. They didn't. It got worse. Every 2 or 3 days, I'm in the office getting threatened. Now, right before Christmas, I hear the Virginia State Police are coming in to do an investigation about the Carter case and supposedly what I told, you know, what I testified to in November. And I'm thinking, great, they're going to put people on the polygraph because the state police has the authority. They have to ask because they work from the attorney general's office. They can petition the governor, the way I understand it, so they can order the Commonwealth attorney to go on a polygraph. So I said, great, you know, that's what I'm thinking. Birch will go on a polygraph. Beamer will go on the polygraph. They'll interview my witnesses from years ago. I'll go on a polygraph, and they'll find out that I'm telling the truth. And even before this thing goes to the second habeas after New Year's, they'll find out that evidence was really withheld. Okay? So I'm all excited. Now, this is how rotten somebody was at dispatch. I'm in my car one day. There's an unmarked, you know, a piece of crap car, because I was undercover, and the radios were hidden under the seat. So I had the radio on. I'm driving up Route 7, and then dispatcher comes across and says, my new number was CID1, right across the frequency, so everybody could hear in the county. CID1. There are some special agents from the Virginia State Police Bureau of Criminal Investigation. They want to talk to you about your testimony. Go to the Sterling substation and talk to them. So I get on the mic and say, thanks for advertising. You know, purposely done. So I go in. There's two agents in there, a female and a guy named Bill O'Connor that I knew when I was in the – I got removed from the sheriff's office at a point in time when I was working on narcotics around 84, 83, 84, 85, and I was assigned, sworn in as a Virginia State Trooper, and I was on a state police undercover task force for over a year and a half with other narcotics investigators from each jurisdiction in Northern Virginia, and it was run by the Virginia State Police. So we had sworn in as a Virginia State Trooper. We had powers of arrest all over the state. And I was on there, like I said, over 18 months. And I knew Bill was one of the regular investigators, but he wasn't assigned to narcotics. So I walk in thinking this is going to be great. And the first thing out of his mouth, he says, I think this is a bunch of BS. I think somebody paid you off. So I wanted to kill the guy, right? So now, I said, what? What are you talking about? Yeah, I think this is a bunch of BS. I think somebody paid you off for your testimony, and I'm getting ready, and I want to punch the guy out. And I says, really? I says, are you going to talk to my witnesses? He says, what witnesses? Witnesses who I know will remember from years ago some things about me going to the mansion or whatever. And I haven't heard to talk to these people for years, the witnesses, right? He goes, why would I talk to them? Well, you just said that you thought I just made this testimony up. But I'm not talking to anybody's witnesses. So basically I said, F you, and I leave. Now I'm totally down and depressed. I haven't gotten any sleep, you know, for weeks. So I go home and I call up the defense attorney, Edwards, and I said, you ain't going to believe what happened. I thought the state police was coming in, and because the attorney general asked them to come in, because the attorney general's office has to handle the habeas motion for the state of Virginia, because Carter's in jail in a state prison, so yeah, the attorney general would be the one handling the habeas motion, not Bill Birch, the county prosecutor. So he tells me, Doug, you know what's going on here? And I says, what's going on is I'm going to lose my job, and I don't know why. All I did was tell the truth. He says, listen, I'm going to have my private investigator, his name is Gary, I remember all these names like it was yesterday, Gary Gochenauer. He's going to come down and talk to you and explain some stuff to you. So anyway, later that night, Gary came over, the next morning, I don't remember what it was, and he comes to the apartment, and he says, do you know what's going on here? I said, yeah, I'm going to lose my job. I'm going to lose my career, and I don't understand why the sheriff's not backing me up. And he says, well, I can't tell you specifics because, you know, you're going to be a witness after New Year's in 2 or 3 weeks in January, but I can tell you this. If we win the habeas motion, that's why they already had the habeas motion. Not because they knew about me, but they had other misconduct and corruption that was withheld from Carter's defense attorney, but none of my stuff, because they didn't know about it. He says, if we win a new trial, we're going to prove that Sheriff Isom himself perjured himself at Doug Carter's original trial years ago. Now I'm thinking, no wonder he ain't backing me up and doing it. No wonder the can of worms statement. The can of worms is going to lead back to him. Because if they're going to accuse him of perjury at the Carter's trial, and that's what got him convicted, you know, part of the conviction, because the only witness against Carter was his wife, and I'm thinking, Jesus, here I am going to my boss, the sheriff of the county, the highest law enforcement officer in Loudoun County, saying, why aren't you doing an IA, internal affairs investigation? Why aren't you putting on the polygraph? And he's saying to me, well, it's not, that has nothing to do with the department. Yeah, it does. I work for you. Vernon Beam is one of your captains. Well, it's between you and Birch, and we're not putting you on, keep your mouth shut. The reason why he was saying that, because he knew, hey, I'm going to do an investigation that's going to lead back to me.
And there it is.
So that's yep. What happened when the PI told me. So I'm thinking, man, am I really sunk now? So anyway, between that time and this, now this is like around Christmas, the habeas motion, the big one, was going to be in January of 1992. So the private investigator tells me, do you know where these witnesses are? I said, Jesus, you know, Bill Harris, the guy I talked to years ago, he was retired. He was out in Colorado. Mary was the county probation officer who then moved on to federal U.S. probation officer. She was based at, I think, Martinsburg, West Virginia. Ed, who was my roommate, who I was living with during my divorce, he was there when Mrs. Carter picked me up, and I told him everything that happened. He's now a U.S. customs agent in McAllen, Texas. So I told him, yeah, they're all spread all over the country. So I said, why? He says, well, I'm going to have to track them down and go talk to them. So what happened was I had no contact with those witnesses. I haven't seen them for years. So now fast forward to January 2nd, 1992. Here's the habeas motion, the big one, and the court, you know, there's reporters in the courtroom, and now it's packed. It wasn't like the first one in November, just three or four people. It's packed to the walls because now the papers got a hold of it. You know, the papers, because there was this battle going on in the papers between me and the prosecutor. I wouldn't let it go. Every time they told me to keep my mouth shut, I'm talking to another reporter. So not only did the local Loudoun Times Mirror get involved, but then, and I got to give credit to this guy. He's still alive. I talk to him every now and then. His name is Brett Phillips. He's the founder at the time and editor of a new paper in Loudoun called Leesburg Today. He's the one that really pushed my story and got all this out in the open. It was Leesburg Today, and then the Washington Post got in on it. The local bureau of the Washington Post was based in Leesburg. They got in on it, and all the local news stations went on it. So now it was like all over the place. Long story short, January 2nd, 1992, I walk into the courtroom, and it's packed. And in the courtroom, when I look on the side, I see Bill Harris. I see Mary. I see Ed Lacey. They look at me. They nod. And now the prosecutor for the state, his name was Bob Condon, he comes over because he sees me looking at these, and he says to them, who are you? And Bill says, Bill Harris. And he turns around and he goes, who are you? Edgar Lacey. And then Mary's sitting, who are you? Mary gives a name, Mary Morris. She's a different name now. She's married. And so he kind of looks now bewildered because he knows who they are now. He knows because I mentioned those names to the state police officer. I said, these are my witnesses you can talk to. I know they have to remember something. So now he knows, wow, they're here. So what happened was, of course, when I testify, you know, when you finish testifying, you're in the witness room. You don't know what anybody else is testifying right. to. So I was the first witness. I get on, and basically, long story short, for time, I testify what I just told you in the audience on the show. So I get off. And, of course, now I'm getting grilled by the assistant attorney general, Bob Condon. You know, he's trying to make me look like I'm a liar and all this type of stuff, and I'm not. I was tough to him, and the judge kept telling him to back off. And he wouldn't. And then finally the judge says, Ms. Conn, back off. So he ticked me off so bad, I lost it on the stand. I just lost my temper because I wasn't getting any sleep. And I said, Your Honor, I got to tell you something. And then Condon says, there's no more questions, Your Honor. He's going to keep quiet. And the judge turned around to me and said, Detective Papa, because I'm now back on the department, Investigative Papa, what do you want to say, Mr. Papa? And I tell him, I'm sorry, Your Honor, for blowing up like this, but it's been hell since November. I said, I haven't gotten any sleep. I've been threatened with my job. They don't want to do an IA. The sheriff's telling me he's opening up the camp. So and now the courtroom is packed. The reporters are just, and I just unloaded, right? And he's objecting. The judge is telling him to sit down, continue, Mr. Papa. And I said, you know, I just don't know what's going on. And so he let me talk for like 5-10 minutes. Everybody's writing. And then I finished. He said, is there anything else you want to say? This is judge. His name was Arthur Sinclair. He was a retired judge brought in specifically to handle the habeas motion. So I said, no, that's it. And I'm sorry if I blew up your honor. It's no problem, blah, blah, blah. And then he says to Conn, you got any questions for him? No. Well, then, of course, now it's, you know, John Edwards' turn to talk to me and, you know, cross-examine me. So he tells me, tell us about the gun, the mansion. He goes, I guess Mrs. Carter was saying that she not only ever took me to pick me up the house, but she never took me to the mansion, which was a lie. I was in the mansion. I can describe it. So I didn't know what they would do, and I found out later on why they did this. They had a big blackboard up there. So John Edwards, the defense attorney for Mr. Carter, said, can you describe what the property looks like that you went 2 years ago? Caught, you know, the estate in Middleburg. And I said, yes. And can you describe what's inside the house? So I got up there, and I started the driveway, and the houses, you know, the servant quarter, the guest house is over there, and you make a turn, and you go into this little mud room. There's a washer and dryer. Oh, the bedrooms were up on the top. Down the bottom is a ping pong table. I'm describing the whole mansion because she testified that she never took me to the mansion. Well, if I never was in the mansion, how the hell I know what the property looked like?
Right.
So, you know, I'm on a testifying. That's the end of that. I'm out. I guess my witnesses testified, and Judge Sinclair said he's going to... Now, this went on for 2 days, okay? He said, I'm going to need some time to review all this. Now, I can tell you this. In the 2 weeks that he was reviewing, they didn't say boo to me. There was no harassment. There was no threats about losing my job. Then one of the secretaries came over one day and says, Doug, I got to tell you something. When Judge Sinclair comes back and says Carter stays in jail, he doesn't deserve a new trial, they're going to go after you for perjury and this. I said, they can do what they want. I didn't lie, you know? And was they're all thinking that Carter's not going to win a new trial.
Right.
Long story short for time, but this time I got an attorney because the FBI said, you need to get an attorney. I didn't have any money. Great guy. Pro bono, $1. His name was John. He's on CNN now all the time. His name was John Flannery. He was a former assistant U.S. attorney out of Southern District of New York. He was one of the best criminal defense attorneys in Loudoun County. One of the reporters says, I can't afford it. He's a $400 attorney, you know. I lost my job. I pulled my retirement. So I went up to him one day. I called him up, and he says, Doug Pop, I've been looking at the news. Come up and see me. I walked into his office the next day. He said, you got a dollar in your pocket? I said, yeah. I take out a dollar. He says, let's give him hell. I'll see what I can do. I'm your attorney for a dollar. He did. He put the sheriff through hell. It didn't work because in Virginia, the law was that the sheriff was a constitutional officer. We can hire and fire at will. And so, you know, it was wrongful termination, but the courts could never force him to put me back to work. So that's the gist of that. So anyway, that's happened. 2 weeks went by. John calls me up and says, Doug, Judge Sinclair's coming back with his decision. And we go back in the courtroom. Now, in comes Sheriff Isom and Charlie Cooper, undersheriff. And I think it was Jeff Brown, one of the captains, and Vernon Beamer, all the bud buddies, I call them, right? All the ones that were involved in the Carter case.
Sure.
And they were looking at me with the smirks, like, hey, we got you now, buddy, you know, all this. Judge comes in. He starts reading this legal thing. And then he says this. And when he said this, I turned around and looked at them. They all put their heads down because they knew what was coming next. I remember this just like it was 25 years ago. And he says, after you read this legal thing, you know, they're all looking at me laughing like, hey, we got you now, right? So he says, this court testimony has to make a decision it would rather not make. He just told them he doesn't believe anybody but me. They put their heads down. And the next thing he says, and it was almost exact words, I'll paraphrase, but almost exact words was, based on the testimony of Mrs. Carter, the prosecutor Bill Birch, Captain Vernon Beamer, Doug Papa, and his witnesses, the court believes Doug Papa's story to be credible, backed up by credible witnesses. William Douglas Carter needs to be released immediately from state prison and given a new trial where all the evidence will be presented in a couple of months. And the courtroom went ballistic. So he got out of jail, and I'm thinking, great, everything's going to be good for me now because, you know, it's out in the open. Things got progressively worse. Mm. The threats, you know, you're going to be demoted. They actually suspended me because I kept talking to the papers. They demoted me. They actually demoted me when Inside Edition came out in January 92, right after that, and did a story. And then the Current Affair did one. And then in April 92, now I'm still on the department. I was one of these guys that, you know, got fired and start, you know, like bad blood, they say, and starts attacking.
Sure.
I was attacking these guys while I was still a cop in the police department. So now April's coming around, and my attorney, John, said that CBS News is coming out, 60 Minutes people, and they want to do a story. Well, the paper's got a hold of it. You know, they're coming out to interview Doug. I'm in the sheriff's office. You better not talk to 60 Minutes. You better not talk to CBS News crew. You're going to get fired, okay? You know, if they already suspended me once, for talking to the press like a month before. So he said, you're on thin ice, mister, and all this. Now I'm on the department for 12 years, okay? Detective, investigator. Nothing bad in my file at all. So I walk out. I ignore him, and I walk out. And then, yeah, 60 Minutes crew came out from CBS, but they end up telling me the producer was Howard L. I remember this, Howard L. Rosenberg. And what he told me was how they found out about it was the head of the Fraternal Order of Police in Washington, D.C. But see, as a deputy, we couldn't belong to a union. But anyway, this FOP president in Washington, D.C., Fraternal Order of Police, was reading and watching my stories on the news. And he called up a contact he had at CBS News and said, there's a cop out in Loudoun County that's getting screwed. You may be interested in doing a story. So that's what prompted CBS to come out. So they came out, they interviewed me, and they said they wanted to do it on a CBS, a 60-minute spinoff called Street Stories with Ed Bradley. And sure, that's what it was on. It was on a Thursday. But while they were up there, the sheriff demoted me to civil process because I was talking to now to CBS News. And they followed me, putting the uniform on and with short pants, because I had to borrow it. And then while I was going around serving process, the news crew was following the cruiser. And then some during that day, his name was Terry McCracken, another buddy of the sheriff, lieutenant. He got me on the radio, said, meet me at the parking lot. And no, that's what it was, the old good old boy.
Right, right.
Of his butt. So he said, meet me in the parking lot. And he says, get in my car, give me a badge and gun. You're basically fired, something like that. Sort of continuing talking. So they fired me, you know, when the news crew was up there. And CBS came out. It was the premiere episode on Thursday night in, I think it was May of 1992, Street Stories with Ed Bradley, and I was the first story, and it was titled Badge of Courage. And they did the whole story on me, and they put in there, while we were up there filming, the sheriff fired Doug Papa. So, Mike, that's the story of my 12-year plea went down the drain.
Amazing.
I could never get back on a police department in the United States because of what I did. The applications, all we know, are the applicants, and, you know, because you talk against other cops, you're done as a cop. So that was the end of that. Long story, real short. I know we only got like 15 minutes left. 2 months later, in June of 92, in this 2 month period, I was living off my retirement. So I don't have a police retirement anymore. I live on Social Security now. I was doing some PI work for a couple of attorneys who wanted me to look into some murder cases on appeals. And so I was doing that. Long story short, one day I'm in my apartment. Now, a good friend of mine, he died a couple of years from cancer. Great guy. I worked undercover with him. I actually trained him when he went undercover. His name was Pete Becerra. He got out of narcotics. He got promoted to sergeant in patrol. He's on lunch. He comes over to my house. He's in uniform. He's over my, but we're talking. I get a call from this guy who was a lieutenant on the sheriff's office. His name was Don Moore. And he says, Doug, I'm in the area. I come over talking to you. Yes, you come over. He doesn't know Pete's in there. He comes in. Pete's sitting there in uniform. Now, remember this. Uniform cop sitting there. He comes in. The first thing he tells me is, you know I got fired yesterday. I said, no. He says, yeah, because he wanted to run against the sheriff the next election. He says, yeah, the secretary said that, told the sheriff that while he was out to lunch, he saw me going through his desk. So they fired me. Now, I'm thinking that sounded a little bizarre to me, right? But what he says next sounded out of this world. Now, I worked undercover almost 9 years of a 12-year police career. I bought guns, explosives, drugs, stolen property, you name it, I did it. I never heard anything like this. This is what comes out of his mouth, sir. He says, what are you doing for money? I said, some PI works. You know, it was in Virginia, you didn't need a PI license to be a PI back then. So he says, well, I got an offer for you. What? This is what he says. Exactly. I remember the exact words. I'm involved with some ex-cops from New York and New Jersey. We're getting ready to kidnap one of the heirs to the DuPont chemical fortune and his wife. We want to hire you, about $500 a day we could pay you, to help us surveillance and tracking these people because you know how to do this. What do you think?
Oh, sign me up.
Well, wait. Pete's mouth drops open. I'm looking at him, and I'm saying, what the hell did you just say? And he says it again. We're in an operation to kidnap one of the heirs to the DuPont chemical fortune and his wife. And then he proceeds to tell me this story. It's like 1,000 heirs. This guy gets $100,000 a month. And he works for this guy that ran for president years ago called Lyndon LaRouche. And the father doesn't like, this guy's like in his 30s, right? He's not a kid. And he's giving this money to LaRouche. So we're going to kidnap him. And then he mentions this word that I never heard before in my life. He says, we're going to deprogram him. We have a deprogram into the right way of thinking. I'm saying, what the hell are you talking about? He goes, oh, it's like reverse brainwashing. So then he starts naming names, okay? Gail and Kelly and Bob Point and all these people like this. And I'm thinking he's nuts. So he says, what do you think? And I says, let me think about it. So he leaves, and Pete's sitting there, and Pete says, Doug, what the hell is he talking about? And I said, I don't know. It sounds crazy, right? And he says, yeah. And I said, do me, I said, Pete, you trust me? He goes, yeah, absolutely. I trust you with my life. I says, do me a favor. Don't mention this to anybody. He says, why? He says, just don't mention to anybody this even happened. So he leaves. The minute Pete leaves, I call up Scott Sutherland from the FBI, who was doing the investigation on the sheriff's office, the corruption investigation, and I tell him this crazy story. And he says, it sounds crazy. But he says, let me check it out. The next morning, he calls me up at 7 o'clock in the morning, and he says, Doug, it's not crazy. These guys are all doing kidnappings, but five agents are on their way out with a proposition for you. Stay there. So these agents come out into my apartment, and basically what they wanted me to do, they said, how did you leave it with Don? I says, I left it open. I said, let me think about it. So they say, we want you to go undercover for us and infiltrate this ring. They've been doing kidnappings. And don't call them up until we get the Title III set up on everybody's phone. My phone, his, make on the sheriff's office. That's how they started the undercover operation from the FBI. That was in June of 1992. It was supposed to be a two-week operation. It went all the way through June. Now, July and August was the retrial of Carter. So while I'm doing this, I also testified at the retrial of Carter, and he was found not guilty at the retrial. He was a free man after spending 5 years in jail. Wow. So all this time, I'm still doing the undercover thing. It went all the way to September, October of 1992, and then they locked everybody up and all the conspirators. And then I moved to Denver. The FBI moved to Denver while I was testifying. I wasn't in witness security. I didn't want to go in there. And that's what happened with that case. While I was undercover for the FBI, I made 60 hours of recordings from body wires that I had on, and they had 100 hours of wiretap Title III recordings, and they locked all these people up. Real briefly, I want to hit on this because this is very important. When the habeas motion was going on in the Carter trial back in January, the habeas motion, not the trial, the habeas motion in January, okay, after Judge Sinclair released Doug Carter from jail and said he deserves a new trial, Bob Condon, who was the Assistant Attorney General for the state of Virginia, who handled the habeas motion, and his boss, who we worked for, his name was John Russell. Bob Condon was an okay guy. John Russell is another POS, and I'll tell you why. After Carter was released, both of these guys talked to the press, and in essence is what they said, that when they ordered the state police to come up, when I thought the state police were going to get to the truth and put everybody on the polygraph and told my witnesses, they said this to the press. Can you imagine law enforcement officers, attorney generals, saying this?
Oh, sure.
That it wasn't our job to prove Doug Papa was telling the truth. It was our job to discredit him because we wanted Carter to stay in prison and not get a new trial. Well, the papers hammered him on that. Have you ever heard something like that?
That's
not the job of the criminal justice system to get to the truth. It's the job to discredit the cop who put his career on the line, and these two SOBs are making the statement to paper. Now, why am I bringing this up? Because if the trial of the kidnappers in December of 1992, John Russell was still the senior attorney general for the state of Virginia. And I hope he sues me because I've been writing about this for years. He testifies in federal court in Alexandria, Virginia, the Southern District of Virginia, for the kidnappers, believe it or not. And he tells on the stand that he talked to cops that knew me and said I had a reputation of being a liar and fabricating evidence.
Ugh.
I never had a case with John Russell. I wouldn't know John Russell if I bumped into him on the street. So Larry Leiser was the U.S. attorney. I'm in the witness room. He comes in like a crazy man, and he's all pissed off. And he says, Doug, are you a bad cop? What have you done in your career? You need to let me know. My case is going down. I said, what are we talking about? He says, the number two guy in the attorney general's office, state of Virginia, just got on the stand and said you were a POS.
Yeah, yeah.
That you lie? I says, Larry, I never lied under oath. I never did nothing wrong in search warrants. You can call any cop. I work with FBI agents, ATF, Secret Service. You call anybody. He says, Doug, why would this guy? I have no idea why he was doing. I said, the only thing I know about John Russell, he was ticked off at me when he made that stupid comment months ago about, that wasn't their benefit to tell him the truth, to discredit me. So he says, I need to call some people. So the Larry, and I got the transcripts later on. When I wrote a story last year. It's on the Baltimore Post-Examiner website. It's 80 pages in 6 chapters, and people got to read it. It's my story. It's free. It's called Police Work, The Breaking of an Honest Cop. I mentioned everybody's name in that story, including the ones I'm talking about now. It's the whole story of what happened to me. Anyway, to get back to this, when Larry Leiser cross-examined John Russell on the stand, he said, can you name the cops who told you this? Of course, he couldn't. Give me 10 cops. Can't tell you. 5 cops. No. Anybody. Well, I'll give you 2. He names Warren Shand, and he said, who's that? He's the assistant special agent charged for the Virginia State Police. And he mentions this guy named Ralph Marshall, another special agent for the Bureau of Criminal Investigation. And he says, yes, I spoke to them recently, and they said when Doug was on the task force or something, his reputation, he's a bad cop, he lies to them, all type of stuff, and search warrants. Total BS. So what does Larry do? He subpoenas. I'm in the witness room the following morning, and in comes Warren Shand. Of course, we can't talk because there's a federal marshal in there, and he looks at me, and then I see Rick Ford, an FBI agent I work with on organized crime cases for years. He comes in, he nods at me, my supervisor, and all these people coming in, and I'm like, what the hell's going on? Well, what happened was, in 60 seconds, he puts them all on the stand, and they all say Doug was a good cop, he never lied, he's not corrupt, and blah, blah, blah. But the crucial witness was Warren Shand, who Russell said he spoke to and told him what he testified to. And I got the transcripts at home. It's in the Breaking of an Honest Cop story, okay? John Russell should have been prosecuted federally for perjury. But let me tell you what happened. Warren Chan gets on the stand. Larry Leiser says, do you know John Russell? Yeah, I do, blah, blah, blah. When was the last I talked to him? Oh, I don't remember. 85, 86? Really? Because it's 1992, and he said he spoke to him a while ago. So he says, do you know who Doug Popper is? Yes. Who is he? He was a detective assigned to the task force. I was a supervisor in the state police. What do you know about him? Good cop, great guy. Yeah, nice guy. He made a lot of cases. The courts acted on it. What about his reputation for honest integrity? Oh, no problem as far as I'm concerned. Larry says, well, Mr. Shand, this is great. I got the transcript. Mr. Shand, what if I were to tell you? See how I remember this stuff from 20-something years ago?
I love it.
Mr. Shand. What if I were to tell you, this is the exact thing he said, from that very witness stand you're sitting in, John Russell said that he spoke to you a couple of weeks ago, and you told him Doug Popper's reputation was of a cop who couldn't be trusted. Warren Shand looks at him and says, I haven't spoken to John Russell for years, 95, 86, and I never spoke to him about Doug Popper. As far as I know, Doug was a good guy when he worked for me. Russell committed perjury to get those kidnappers off. Then he was going to put Ralph Marshall on the stand, but he doesn't. But you know what happened to Ralph Marshall? He talks to him outside the courtroom, I heard later on, and he tells him the same thing. And Ralph Marshall says, oh, yes, I did have a conversation. From what I heard, what he said was, I did have a conversation with John Russell. But he said was, he didn't say anything bad about me. But then he tells the prosecutor, by the way, I tape record every conversation that comes in my phone at state police headquarters, and I've done it for years, because he worked in BCI, Bureau of Criminal Investigations. So Larry says, you mean you got a recording of John Russell? Yeah, it was like a minute conversation. He didn't say anything bad about me. So Larry says, go get the tape, okay? I heard that tape could have put John Russell, combined with Warren Chan's testimony, in federal prison for perjury during a federal trial. And you know what the U.S. attorney did, Larry Leiser's boss? I heard, I was right there. Now, Larry Leiser was a good guy. I heard him tell the FBI agent, it came from upstairs, meaning the boss over him, we're not going after John Russell for perjury in Virginia. Can you imagine that? Now, I can't get into the rest of the kidnapping case because it's involved, but sure. All those guys that were charged with the alleged kidnapping, trying to kidnap Louis DuPont Smith, who was the heir to the DuPont chemical fortune, all those people involved were involved in the prosecution of Lyndon LaRouche back in the middle 80s when they were all federal prosecutors. Don Moore worked on the case. John Russell worked on this. All those people, long story short, a lot of the people with the LaRouche organization were charged criminally with like credit card fraud and stuff like that. Well, John Russell prosecuted the state cases in Virginia. Don Moore, who was one of the people under arrest in the kidnappers case, worked for him as one of the investigators. The defense attorney for the father who was financing the alleged kidnapping operation, wasn't alleged, I mean, that thing was taped, was the former prosecutor out of Boston, who was now a private attorney, who put Lyndon LaRouche in jail. So, this was like, I mean, you go online and read this stuff.
Oh, my word.
It's just like, it's total corruption. But my thing was, I didn't care about all this stuff. What I care about is, to this day, if you're listening to this, John Russell is a practicing attorney to this day in Richmond, Virginia. You are a POS, Russell. You destroyed my police career when you could have told those state police agents, get to the truth, put people on the polygraph, let's find out if Doug's lying, who's lying, and you did not do it. Then you had the nerve to get in federal court and make lies about my reputation that blew up in your face. So screw you, John Russell. And that's what I got to say. But that's what I went through, man. That's what I went through, a year's worth of hell, for coming out and testifying as a cop to the truth that all cops are supposed to do when you have a badge on your thing. You know, we didn't even get to the damn massacre.
I know. I'm going to have you back. Look, you had a quarter of a century of injustices that were rammed down your throat. I was not about to stop you from telling your story.
You know, I appreciate it. You know, the only therapy you get, and I got to tell you something real quick. Oh, I forgot to tell you. Frank Serpico, I spoke to him 2 days ago, said hello and thank you to both of you guys.
Oh, Frank's a great guy.
He said, make sure you don't forget, I did a 10-part series a couple months ago on the Baltimore Post Examiner. I interviewed Frank Serpico for months, and he told his story to me that he never told anybody. It's on the Baltimore Post Examiner. It's a 10-part series. Frank Serpico tells a story. He unloaded on stuff that he'd never told anybody. He gave me the exclusive interview. But I talked to him, you know, a couple times a week if I can. And he says, hey, make sure you tell the Hagmans hello from Frank. Don't forget. So I almost forgot.
You tell Frank Serpico to come back anytime, that we think a lot of him. And I'm going to tell you something, Doug. Again, 25 years plus of injustices. This is incredible. I'm so glad you took the time to lay this out. But you know, this is reality. This the corruption beyond
it is.
Description.
It's you know, I still get, when I write stories a lot on police corruption, and I always put that in there, that I don't care what's going on in your police department. The only way, there's so much bad rep that cops get today, and 90% of cops in this country are honest.
Yep.
It's the 10% that destroy the reputation of every other cop, either through bad shootings, corruption, misconduct, and lies. And a lot of times, this corruption and misconduct is coming from sheriffs and police and their buddies up at the top that get away with a lot of stuff that people at the bottom, including out here at the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, I know a lot of ex-cops who were screwed by sheriffs over the past 20 years that get away with domestic violence and other crimes that cops would be arrested for right here in Las Vegas, Nevada. That's a whole other story we could talk about another time. You can't get me going on this stuff because I'm so passionate about it. You know, I wish I could show the camera. It's on the laptop. There are no notes here. There's no newspaper articles. When I talk from memory, because Frank Serpico told me one thing, and he's absolutely correct when I interviewed him. He goes, Doug, you and me do this. We never have notes when we talk. You know why? Because somebody who's telling the truth, you remember that truth for the rest of your life. You don't have to look at notes and newspapers. Right. I'm not looking at nothing while I'm talking to you. There's nothing here. There's an empty piece of paper and a pen because I had to write something down, some of the information. It all comes from the heart. Because you know what? When you're telling the truth, you can keep rattling off facts and stuff because it's never going to change because it's the absolute truth. I'm sorry I lost. The only thing I ever wanted to do in my life was be a cop and retire as a cop, okay? When I wrote that story, The Breaking of an Honest Cop, the last thing I put in there is this. And if I get emotional, I'm sorry, okay? I'm a man, but this bothers me. All those years that I gave to these casinos and did the honorable thing and I was always up front, okay? What I always missed was being a cop. And that bothers me to this day, that I'm going to die not being a police officer.
You know what, Doug? I understand, and you have every right to be emotional. I want to say thank you on behalf of our audience, on behalf of us. Thank you. You're a stand-up guy. Please come back and talk with us about Las Vegas and other issues. You've got an open-door invitation. You're the man. Thank you.
I appreciate both of you for coming on and let me talk. I know I rattled on, but I really appreciate it.
Hey,
both of you.
I'll tell you what. Again, a quarter of a century of injustice, you have every right to. May God bless you. We'll be in touch.
Thanks a lot, guys.
All right.
Be good. Stay safe.
Well, God bless every folks. I'm blown away. I got nothing. Have a good weekend.